Welcome to the Beyond the Pearls podcast, based on the Morning Report series from Elsevier. This podcast has been adapted for audio in collaboration with series editor Dr. Raj Dasgupta, as well as the volume editor for each book. Each episode features an in-depth case dissection format and aims to deliver practical, concise, and easy-to-digest information. And now, here's today's episode.
Let's do this question. 62-year-old woman is evaluated for management of type 2 diabetes. Her medical history is significant for hypertension. Her meds are metformin. She's on an SGLT2 inhibitor. She's on atorvastatin, hydrochlorothiazide. On physical exam, her blood pressure is 140 over 80. The remainder of the physical exam is normal. Labs have a hemoglobin A1C of 7, an estimated GFR of 50, and a urine albumin to creatinine ratio of 90. So obviously that's going to be elevated, right? What's the terminology? We're going to call that moderately increased, all right? Which of the, don't use the words microalbuminuria anymore. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? So we have a diabetic, we definitely have some hypertension, we have an A1C, not a goal. And more importantly, the GFR is above 30, it's 50, and it has a, you know, moderately increased albuminuria. What do you want to do here, folks? Should we start off by, is metformin going to be the right answer? Probably not. Do they probably need, she's already on metformin. Should we stop it? Probably not. We need to, not even a goal in the A1C. So I wouldn't stop the metformin. It's not going to solve the problems. I wouldn't stop the SGLT2 inhibitor. And it comes down to starting, you know, a calcium channel blocker or an ACE inhibitor. And what do we talk about? It's going to be ACE first. No questions asked. You want to start an ACE. Is there a role for calcium channel blockers in, you know, dumping protein in the urine? There is, we'll talk about it, but definitely the answer here is going to be A. Good. So let's talk about this, do a little deeper dive. So in these cases over here, that you definitely want to think about starting the ACE inhibitor. This is a patient with a GFR less than 60, with an albumin to creatinine ratio that exceeds more than 30 milligrams per gram. This is a setup for what we talked about. Step one, start an ACE or ARB. Now, I wanted to mention about CCBs and proteinuria. You know, the, you know, CCBs, though, calcium channel blockers, though they're not, you know, first line, they, you know, for those who can't tolerate ACEs and ARBs, we may consider that. They do have an anti-protein effect, anti-proteinuric effect, and it really is the, what we call the non-dihydropyridines. What are examples of non-dihydropyridines? Things like diltiazem, things like verapamil. And people are going to ask me why. So I didn't put this here to give you, like, you know, any type of like worrisome or just, I know, but, you know, when we talk about this, this is a classic, you know, thing we all learned back in the days of, oh, step one. But what happens when you actually dilate or constrict the afferents or dilate or constrict the efferents? And I'm going to answer the question, why do non-dihydropyridines, you know, work better than dihydropyridines in reducing proteinuria? So remember, when we talk about the afferent, what's the classic things that's going to, you know, squeeze the afferent? Things like, you know, non-steroidal medications. Non-steroidals work on these prostaglandins. Remember, prostaglandins are dilators. If you block them, they vasoconstrict. So definitely, constricting the afferent, definitely think about non-steroidals. How do ACE inhibitors work? Well, ACE inhibitors in itself, that angiotensin II is a very potent vasoconstrictor of the efferent. So if you give an ACE inhibitor, what's going to happen is that you're going to dilate the efferent. You're going to dilate the efferent. So that's going to be the way ACE inhibitors work. Now, calcium channel blockers, dihydropyridines, you know, they mainly work on the afferent. So if it's going to work on the afferent, what's it going to do to reduce protein? Well, it's going to constrict the afferent, because if you constrict it, it's going to decrease dumping protein into the urine, you know? And, but non-dihydros work both on the afferents and the efferents. So not only are the non-dihydros, things like verapamil and diltiazem, going to constrict the afferent, it dilates the efferent. So therefore, you decrease the GFR, you're not going to spill as much protein in the urine. And of course, metformin, you know, you don't have to stop it. You know, when do we think about stopping metformin? When the GFR is going to be less than 30? Of course, these are patients we were about developing lactic acidosis from. But, you know, in this patient over here, patients on metformin, on SGLT2 inhibitor, you know, and his A1C is not even a goal yet. So I would not stop it in this case. And then the last thing I want to talk about, and it always seems I was going to end early, but it seems like I can't. So let's talk about, you know, just one thing about acute kidney injury. You know, acute kidney injury is in general, you know, described as a decrease in urine output, fluid retention, metabolic acidosis, hyperkalemia, hyperphosphatemia. Those are things that characterize, you know, acute kidney injury. How do we define acute kidney injury? I like using KDIGO for your boards and in clinical, the Kidney Disease Improving Global Outcomes. And I put some of the definitions of it, which include an increase in serum creatinine greater than 0.3 milligrams per DL within 48 hours, an increase in serum creatinine to greater than 1.5 times the baseline over 7 days, or urine volume of less than 0.5 mL per kilogram per hour for 6 hours. So these are the some of the ways that, you know, KDIGO defines, you know, acute kidney injury. So acute kidney injury, you know, can be divided into three main things. Problems are pre-renal, intrarenal, or post-renal. So of course, pre-renal, you'd always think about someone who's volume down. You would think about someone who has renal artery stenosis. You'd be thinking about someone who's on one way to be manipulating that afferent arteria but causing it to vasoconstrict, or people who have, you know, heart failure and have decreased cardiac output. It's all going to be pre-renal. Post-renal is going to be obstructive urine flow. But of course, a favorite for the boards is intrarenal. And intrarenal can mean damage to one of three areas in the kidney: the tubules, the glomerulus, or the interstitium. So of course, you know, when you think about tubules, everyone's going to mention acute tubular necrosis. When you think about the glomerulus, you can think about glomerular nephropathies, nephritic nephrotic syndrome. But the one I feel goes under the radar, which is why it's going to be a great question for your board exams, is, you know, the interstitium, hence acute interstitial nephritis. And that's what I want to talk about today. So, you know, when we talk about AIN, acute interstitial nephritis, it's a renal condition involving rapid decline in renal function. It's around 10 to 20% of all acute kidney injuries. You know, and what causes, you know, acute interstitial nephritis? Well, it could be medications, and that's 2/3 of cases. So I guarantee that's going to be the question on your board exams. It could be having infections. It could be a systemic condition. Of course, part of it will always be idiopathic. You're just not going to find out. So I really want to focus on drugs, you know, and the most common drugs that can do this are things like antibiotics. So think of beta-lactams, whether it's we talking about penicillins or cephalosporins or carbapenems, quinolones. So whether these patients will be on things like levoquin or things like ciprofloxacin, definitely you would think about cephalosporins can do that, sulfonamides, rifampin, and of course, other drugs are very important when you talk about things like non-steroidals, COX-2 inhibitors, PPIs, you know? And of course, when you say infections, which one? Well, kind of all of them, but of course, I listed a couple here like E. coli, Campylobacter, Salmonella, different viruses can do it, funguses, and even parasites can do it. And immune system and systemic disorders, you think about things like lupus and Sjogren's, even sarcoid. And once again, sometimes you just don't know. So when we talk about the pathophysiology about this, you know, it's very interesting focusing on drug-induced that, you know, the drug itself sometimes, you know, doesn't induce the interstitial nephritis until it just kind of reacts with, you know, cells in the tubule. And once there's an interaction with the cells in the tubule, then it forms, you know, a complex that will rev up your immune system. And when we talk about acute interstitial nephritis, you know, it is a kind of T-cell mediated immunity. It's a type 4 hypersensitive reaction that occurs. So clinical features of this, patients may be asymptomatic, they be non-oliguric or oliguric, they could have some nausea and vomiting, even some flank pain. And where's some of the findings? One of the key findings when I think about interstitial nephritis is sterile pyuria. Why? Because where is all the inflammation? It's going to be in that interstitial space, not in the tubule itself. But you can have white blood cell cast. You can have some proteinuria choosing the subnephrotic range. You can have microscopic hematuria and, of course, some peripheral eosinophilia. So to make the diagnosis, what do? Well, of course, get a urine analysis, get some blood work. I'm not saying you need to do a kidney biopsy, but if it's indicated, it's going to change your management, you could consider that. Treatment is always going to be remove the offending agent first. Then there'll be a, you know, a consideration of steroids, you know, to hasten recovery. And then, unfortunately, in some cases, some patients go on to need renal replacement therapy and they may need dialysis. So with this being said, I know we're kind of nearing the end. I just want to do one question right here to kind of wrap it in all together. So we have a 39-year-old man is evaluated for a serum creatinine level of 2.6 milligrams per DL. His baseline serum creatinine 4 months ago was 0.9. He has no symptoms. 2 years ago, he started lisinopril and amlodipine for hypertension. 1 year ago, he started a PPI for GERD and naproxen for his knee osteoarthritis. 9 months ago, he began atorvastatin for hyperlipidemia. On exam, he's afebrile, blood pressure is 136 over 84, and the remainder of the exam is unremarkable. They get a UA that shows a specific gravity of 1.015, which is normal, pH of 5.5, which is normal. There's 1 plus erythrocytes, 3 plus leukocytes, 1 plus leukocyte esterase, no nitrates, and greater than 100 leukocytes per high-powered field with leukocyte and granular casts. Which of the following drugs should be discontinued in this patient? So this sounds exactly what we've been talking about. This is somebody who comes in with acute interstitial nephritis. And what are going to be the drug combo that we think about? Is it going to be the statin with a calcium channel blocker, amlodipine? Is it going to be the ACE inhibitor and amlodipine? Is it going to be lisinopril and the PPI, which is omeprazole? Is it going to be the naproxen and the atorvastatin? Or is it going to be the naproxen and the omeprazole? Which one seems to be the right answer here? So if you think about what we talked about for the different drugs out there, remember, non-steroidal medications can definitely do it, and proton pumps inhibitors. And I know that we have this classic, you know, kind of like, you know, triad of fever, rash, and peripheral eosinophilia, but what a surprise, it only really occurs in about 10, maybe 30% of cases with AIN. So I put this here because, you know, when we talk about medications that can do this, first off, yes, non-steroidals, including COX-2 inhibitors, can be associated with that. But I really want to jump down to the bottom point that proton pump inhibitors are thought to be a risk factor for development of CKD. And some of these proton pump inhibitors induce AIN, you know, maybe 10 to 13 weeks after exposure. And I put a, you know, a little article up here because, you know, the thought process, PPIs are not as benign as we think. They do a great job. Sometimes you really need to be on them. There are immense inhibitors of the, you know, potassium, hydrogen, potassium, ATPase pump, but they do have consequences, whether we talk about, you know, infections, like the higher risk of C. diff, whether we talk about the higher risk of ventilator-associated pneumonias in some cases, whether we talk about, you know, some of the problems with calcium and absorbing calcium when you're on PPIs. And of course, now it's going to be talking about chronic kidney disease, specifically talking about how PPIs can develop AIN. So something to remember for your boards. And, you know, I just want to say, what are my beyond the pearls for your boards this time? I want to just go through these. Renal recovery through drug-induced AIN is usually complete if the drug is stopped immediately after the onset of kidney injury, and it may take about weeks to several months. You know, an irreversible interstitial fibrosis can develop after 2 weeks of continued exposure, which is why discontinuing the drug is so important. You know, kidney biopsy should be considered if no improvement in kidney function after around 5 to 7 days of discontinuing the medication or the drug that you think is causing it. And early glucocorticoid administration may limit damage associated with drug-induced AIN. And with that being said, everyone, I know I did it again. I know I went over, Aurora, but I really hope you mastered the gallbladder, you mastered diabetic kidney disease. And of course, I had to throw something with AIN. And hopefully, I can't wait to see you in person one day and good luck on your board exams.
Thank you, Dr. Raj. We do have one question in the chat, so I'll just go ahead. If you can't see it, I can go ahead and read it to you.
All right. You know what? I can see it, but I love hearing your voice. Why don't you just read it to me?
Are there known SSRIs or SSRIs? I don't know what that means.
or heme-onc drugs or conditions that we should be aware of as AIN precipitates. And so, SNRIs. So yeah, the answer is that, there are always a lot of case reports and case series. I wouldn't say there's one that's kind of a blanket one you should know about. When you talk about AIN, it's hard to know what drugs will induce it. AIN's been around for a while. And so there've been, associations. We definitely know certain antibiotics are just associated with this. But like what I mentioned, what causes it is when a drug goes through, gets filtered, interacts with the tubules, and when it forms that complex, it revs up your immune system. You get that type 4 hypersensitivity type reaction. So you never know what could do it, and you need to have a very low threshold to think about this. So definitely, when you say hemonc drugs, oh my God, these chemotherapy drugs always do a number on my patients. So the answer is there are some ones that we know for sure based upon our history of giving these medications, but you never know. And that's why it's so hard to make this diagnosis. And you just have to have a very high suspicion. But great question over there. And once again, Roger, thank you so much thank you very much. You're the best. Elena, thank you so much. Everyone who always says these really nice things, you always make my day. It takes a while to make these presentations and really focus it then. I only get 90 minutes. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Beyond the Pearls podcast from Inside the Boards. This podcast is executive produced by Christopher Brightigan and Dr. Patrick Beeman. This podcast is intended for educational purposes only and is not medical advice. Ars longa, vita brevis.